Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Applying for citizenship, a green card, or a visa just to visit the United States, it's a big deal. And as often as the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services refers to the word easy on its red, white, and blue website, the process is complicated. This hour, we're going to talk about bureaucracy of immigration with a local lawyer who specializes in immigration law and one of his clients who has been seeking citizenship for 12 years. First, we turn to the story of another immigration case, this one about a woman out of Texas who pretty much had almost everything going for her in the process. Almost. Joining us now is award-winning television reporter Randy Wallace of Fox 26 in Houston, who broke the story of Margaret Doty. Welcome to the show, Randy.
Well, thank you so much, Ann.
So 64-year-old Margaret Doty, she was a British citizen who refused to take up arms to defend the United States, an oath that all immigrants have to take. Where and when in the process of her application did this occur, and what happened next?
Well, as you know, Ann, you know, they ask you several questions about citizenship, and they got to the question about would you bear arms for the country. And Margaret Doty, who, by the way, let me just real quickly explain to you that Margaret Doty is been really big in the literacy movement. She's kind of well known in the Houston area. She started the Houston Reed Commission. She was awarded by Queen Elizabeth II for the work that she's done to fight literacy. Well, she they asked her about the bearing arms, and she said, "I'm a pacifist. You know, I could not do that." And she pointed out that, you know, if there was some sort of a war here, she would do anything she could to help the country, but there's no way that she could arm herself. Well, the person at the immigration office said, "Look, you're an old lady. No one's going to ask you to pick up a gun, you know, so just say yes." And she said, "No, you know, that she had a moral issue with it." Well, when she returned, they asked her to swear in, and then the same employee told her again, you know, just say yes. So Margaret said, "Now, wait a minute. You just swore me in to tell the truth. Now you're saying you want me to lie about this. I just, in good conscience, I can't do that." So she was raising this under the grounds of a moral issue. Well, this employee at the immigration office told her that she couldn't do that, that it had to be under a religious situation, that she had to, you know, say it was because of religious beliefs. Well, Doty is an atheist, and, you know, she told the woman, "I think you're wrong. I think I can make this this argument under it being a moral issue." So she was basically told that she had until Friday, this was last week, she had until that Friday to find a church to join that would say that they had a problem with bearing arms. So she was basically being told, "Hey, you have to either join a church or you're not going to get your citizenship." I mean, it was a really crazy situation.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the bureaucracy of immigration. My guest right now, Randy Wallace. He is an award-winning television reporter at Fox 26 in Houston. And we're talking about the case of 64-year-old Margaret Doty, British citizen, refused to take up arms to defend the United States and was being asked to lie on her immigration paper and say that she would, or get a church to back her. So what happened then?
Well, basically, she went home, and she's just thinking, this is kind of strange. So she goes home, and she puts a post on her Facebook page, you know, thinking, "Hey, you know, friends, listen to what happened today." Well, it just really took off. And so Doty kind of became sort of a little, it became a real media story at that point, and she had an attorney who basically sent a demand letter, if you will, to immigration saying, "Look, we believe that this is wrong, and that if you continue this or you don't, she doesn't get her citizenship, we'll file suit." She also contacted her local congressman. We were there, I believe it was last Thursday, and the next day was the deadline to where, you know, they told her, "Hey, you either join a church or forget about it." Well, while we were there, we did an interview with her, and then she got word from the congressman's office that immigration had basically said, "Hey, sorry, you know, this is, you can go this coming Wednesday, and we'll get your citizenship." They didn't really come out. They sort of alluded to the fact that a mistake was made, but they really didn't officially kind of say, "This was the mistake. This was the action that we've taken. And the thing that really bothers me about it, Ann, is you've got to wonder, Margaret Doughty is a woman who, she understands the law very well. She's not going to let somebody just sort of run right over her. Mm-hmm. She's very soft-spoken, but she's got to ask questions. And you've got to wonder how many other people have been in that situation, and they were just intimidated. And they went ahead and they either lied or they just went along with whatever immigration was telling them to do.
And she's also a woman of means. She can afford a lawyer. She has connections. She's been in the United States for 30 years. You've said she's been awarded, you know, honors by Queen Elizabeth II, and she knows the Bushes from her work in literacy. This is a person who basically had it all and was still, facing these kinds of obstacles. Do we have any, did you talk to the immigration people about this, and did they tell you why this is a rule or what the rule is that they were using?
We never got any kind of explanation at all from immigration, Ann. I mean, basically, the situation had corrected itself the same day that we aired the story, but I still wanted immigration to kind of explain, how did this mistake happen? Did this employee, was this employee really under the idea that the only way that someone could raise the issue of, I don't want to bear arms, would be under a religious beliefs, not moral beliefs, which, that's obviously not correct. And if this person has been saying that, well, what kind of action did immigration take against that particular employee? I mean, we've got no explanation at all.
And, of course, we invited a representative of the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services to join the show. We sent out multiple requests by phone and by email, and we didn't get a response. So they're not going to join us today to explain it either. All right. So since breaking the story, have you heard of any other people with stories similar to Margaret's? Sometimes that happens to people in our positions.
Right. Yeah. A lot of times people will kind of, you know, they'll say, well, that happened to me. And then they contact you. We haven't heard from anybody yet so far. But then you've got to wonder, too, again, some mm-hmm. of the people I think that are in the situation, they can be a little intimidated, you know, by the government. And if they were misled, they might have the feeling that, oh, well, I don't want to rock the boat. I don't want to say anything. I mean, Margaret Doughty could have just checked the box. And I mean, let's face it, no one is going to ask this little petite 62-year-old woman to pick up a gun and shoot somebody. But it was very important to her to stand up and say, you know what, I'm a pacifist, I do not believe in that, and I'm not going to lie about it for anybody.
Well, and then also, if people did lie about it, do they want to come forward and say they lied about it?
And how troubling is it, too, to have someone in the immigration office, basically, they swear you in, please tell the truth, and then not a minute later, they turn around and sort of suggest that you lie about something. And Margaret brought that up. She said, hey, wait a minute. You just swore me to tell the truth. Now you're asking me to lie, and I can't do that.
How big of a – you're down there in Texas. How big of a deal is the immigration reform at this point, Randy?
It's really big because, of course, we have a huge Hispanic population. So it's something that people really care about here, and they're very interested in. And it's one of those things, and something else too, let me point out, that Margaret Doughty lives in a pretty small beach community, Palacios, which is about an hour and a half south of Houston.
Okay.
So, you know, you kind of wonder, if this is going on in sort of a small municipality, what's going on here in immigration offices that we really don't know about? Are these people being asked to be dishonest? Are they being misled? Are they being intimidated? I mean, this is a big deal when someone wants to say, hey, I want to be a U.S. citizen, and I'm going to do everything by the book. I'm going to follow the law to a T. And these people take it, most of the people anyway, take it very seriously. And it would be troubling to think, well, you know, I had to fib about something, or I couldn't be completely honest. Because, you know, I mean, no one wants to be a citizen of the United States under any kind of false pretense.
Yeah, and by the way, I wanted to reiterate, she's lived here 30 years. It was 12 years ago that she started this process?
Well, no, she's been a permanent resident of the United States, for 30-some years. She has two children here. She's got grandchildren here. And she just recently sort of decided, you know what, I've got family here, and I want to be, a U.S. citizen. I mean, she wanted to get a citizenship. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of for personal reasons that she needed to do that. She had not had any kind of problem at all that she told us about with immigration. She didn't need to do this. It was something that she personally felt, hey, you know, I'm so tied to the United States. I want to be a citizen of the United States.
And by the way, by now, she probably is a citizen.
Yes, and this is kind of the nice thing about the story. She was going through the process with a very close friend of hers from South Africa who had just, you know, had to flee that country under, really tragic circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And their plan was that they were going to be able to be sworn in together, which was this morning. Well, last week with all this going on, it looked like Ann would not be able to be sworn in this morning with her friend. But since immigration did quickly resolve the issue, she's there right now with her friend. They're all told to be there around 7 o'clock in the morning. And if they haven't been sworn in by now, they will be sworn in probably within the next 30 minutes. And I don't know if you've ever been to one of those, but I really love covering them because the people are so happy. They're so proud. And it really kind of it makes me proud to be an American when I go to these things, because you see these people from all over the world that they wanted so badly to be a U.S. citizen that they did everything that they were asked to do. I mean, it's like they followed the letter of the law to a T, and they're so proud. I mean, you see people crying and emotional about it, and it really is one of those moments when you see something like that and you just think, I'm so glad that I'm an American.
Somebody wants to be one of us.
Somebody
wants to join the club.
Exactly.
Well, Randy Wallace, thank you so much for joining me today. I did talk with Margaret via Facebook, actually. She wanted to be with us, and she said you would be very good instead, and we appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. Again, if you ever do this issue again, Margaret would just be a great person for your listeners to hear from, because she's an outstanding, wonderful woman.
All right. Well, Randy Wallace of Fox 26 in Houston, once again, thank you for your time.
My pleasure, Ann.
When we return, we'll continue the discussion of the bureaucracy of immigration. It's easier for some than others and for different reasons. Just depends. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Wexner Heritage Village, home of geriatric planning solutions. Now there's a GPS for families navigating the complex and changing landscape of senior health care. More on Wexner Heritage Village's geriatric planning solutions at whv.org.
Support 89.7 NPR News at $85 and receive the WOSU member card. The member card is good for dining and admission discounts at more than 200 member card partners in Central Ohio. Visit wosu.org/membercard for more information. And thanks for your membership in 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from the Jazz Arts Group, taking jazz to a wilder place as the Columbus Jazz Orchestra returns to the stage at the Columbus Zoo and Aquarium for the 8th season of Jazz Zoo. The summer series kicks off July 12th. Tickets, reserve tables, and more details at jazzartsgroup.org.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In a highly anticipated decision, the U.S. Supreme Court today ruled the Federal Defense of Marriage Act is unconstitutional. The 1996 Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA, was signed into law by President Bill Clinton, barring federal recognition of same-sex marriages for purposes such as Social Security survivors' benefits, insurance benefits, immigration, and tax filing. Section 3 of the law defines marriage as a legal union between one man and one woman as husband and wife, and a spouse as a person of the opposite sex who is a husband or a wife. That provision has been struck down by 8 lower courts before the Supreme Court's 5-4 ruling in United States versus Windsor today. We will cover this decision in depth tomorrow on All Sides with Ann Fisher at 10 a.m., so I hope you'll join us then. Right now, big immigration reforms loom, but for those seeking citizenship now, we wanted to know, what's it like? Joining us now, in a few minutes, I should say, will be a Central Ohio immigration lawyer who works to help his clients gain citizenship. If you have a question or comment for an immigration lawyer, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Dennis Muchnicki, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Hi, joining us now is Dennis Muchnicki. He is a Central Ohio immigration lawyer who works to help his clients gain U.S. citizenship. Welcome to the show, Dennis.
Well, glad to be here.
We keep hearing the word broken come up again and again when it comes to immigration. And is this just about the undocumented worker issue, or does the problem affect those who are seeking citizenship who have legitimate basis for it? They're not part of the DREAM Act. They're not part of the undocumented population.
Well, certainly there are areas that have of the citizenship process that could be significantly improved. There's a lot of discretion given to local INS offices in the way they conducted proceedings, and they are subject to abuse.
Yeah, discretion by locals. We were just talking about a case out of Texas where a woman was being forced to either lie on her application about whether she would take up arms or find a church quickly that would take her in and sign her up and say they oppose violence and so forth. She would do neither. And the immigration services haven't really responded to whether or not this is typical, whether it was a local decision or anything.
Frankly, it's such an incredibly stupid decision that it sounds like something that would be local from Texas. Put it that way.
Okay. Most, like I said, most of the conversation has been about border patrols and how to help undocumented people attain citizenship under certain circumstances. Is there anything in the proposed legislation that you know about that would actually make it easier for documented people who are living here on a green card or on a visa or here legally one way or the other to get citizenship? Is there anything that addresses that issue?
No. I really haven't even heard significant discussion about that issue. The issues have been so loud, as well as the border issues, that some of the other aspects of the provisions really haven't been discussed at all. I've heard very little discussion on this particular topic. And so much of the problem with this issue is just the discretion of locals. I mean, it's not that it's a terribly imponderable process. It can be fairly straightforward. I know one of my clients has indicated a willingness to talk to you, and she got approved fairly straightforward. But there are a whole bunch of pitfalls in the area, but they're more administrative issues than they are issues of legal status.
Not to put you out of business, but why should someone have to get a lawyer to work through the immigration process?
Because so many of the terms have special definitions that aren't in common usage. Plus, people don't, I doubt that very many people pick up the Code of Federal Regulations. and read the regulations that govern the decision-making in the citizenship process. A common example that I can give you is it requires good moral character for 5 years prior to your application. I think as a general rule, that sounds right. But how that standard is applied can be a very slippery slope. For example, if you had a conviction 2 or 3 years before you applied for the citizenship, which would have been outside the 5-year period, but you had been on probation that extended into the 5-year period, that would allow USCIS to go back and look at that prior conviction and kind of wrap it into the 5 years, even though it occurred 6, 7, 8 years beforehand. So there are all these little technicalities in the definitions that wind up that people who need to have someone review their applications before they file them. And we find that quite often, that people had some minor skirmish with the law, and there's a question of how it would impact them once they have their citizenship application pending. USCIS, and I think correctly, views the citizenship process as the last chance to weed out the undesirables. So they're very, very, very strict. And I can give you one example of a guy who had inadvertently, in a sting operation, had sold an alcoholic beverage to a minor who had a fake ID. Now, he didn't mean anything by it, but he was denied citizenship.
Wow.
And we filed an administrative appeal. It was overruled. He questioned whether he wanted to go to federal court, and he decided he didn't want to. He'd just wait another 5 years. But that was, you know, a very minor offense, yet he got strung out for it.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest right now, Dennis Muchnicki. He is a Central Ohio immigration lawyer at the firm Muchnicki and Bittner. We welcome phone calls from people who oppose easing the immigration laws, making it easier to immigrate to the United States. But we do ask that you take on a civil tone and join the conversation in a civil way. So if you can do that, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We don't expect everybody to agree with immigration reform, but we do ask you to be civil and polite to our screener. Joining us now is Suzanne Robbie. She is one of Dennis's clients who's joined us for the show. Welcome, Suzanne.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. It's been 12 years since you first applied for citizenship. Did you expect it to take that long?
No, not really, not at all. First week I'm here, like, we think about we just gonna apply for citizenship right away. We don't even know that it goes through a process and it takes that long to get the citizenship.
Is 12 years typical, Dennis?
Well, if you're measuring it from the date of they enter the country, that's not an unusual length of time. The actual citizenship process doesn't take 12 years, but by the time you move from being a non-immigrant to an immigrant to a legal permanent resident to a citizen, a decade is not unusual.
Suzanne, did you hit any snags along the way? Anything particular that held up the process?
No, actually, for me, as Dennis said, I got my first, I went to somebody to fill my applications for citizenship, and wasn't really clear. I didn't understand how that process would go, what I supposed to put in my application. Mm-hmm. So I think that held it a little bit back. And so finally, I found Dennis, and I went there and I talked to him about my application and my stories where the errors were. So I think other than that, no, everything was fine since I found Dennis.
Yeah, Susan had a non-attorney prepare her initial asylum application, and it was a disaster. It was an incoherent mess, and it got her put initially into a deportation proceeding, and we revised it and wrote a new application for her that set forth her claim, and we took that before the judge, and she won. But okay. That initial application that was prepared by a layperson did set her back quite a bit, a couple of years.
A couple years. So you were seeking political asylum first? Was that what it was?
Okay. Yes, she was.
Okay. Yeah. And what, Susan, what's the paperwork like? When I went to the immigration site, you know, the red, white, and blue site where they say everything's really easy and it looks very colorful and it looks fun. And I filled out enough of it to, you know, to get to the point where they say you would be a great candidate. You shouldn't have any problems. Click here to download the forms. And I didn't do that. But I wondered, when you're looking at the forms, how did they appear to you? Did it appear like a lot? Did it appear like as much as there should be? What did you think?
I think for me, like, the questions were, like, okay, when, you know, first you move here and you're not perfect in English. Mm-hmm. I think it's good to understand, but there is more explanation they need. There's more, I just like anyone to get the attorney, because there is a word that we translate in our own words. It's not mean what they really need. Like, I think the words that they use in it's kind of, it's difficult for us to understand what exactly they ask for.
Can you give me an example of what you mean by that? Can you remember anything?
Like if we have to explain for our, tell me your story, what you're applying for, what's this asylum about. Actually, like for us to think about asylum, like what are you here for, we just say whatever it comes out of our minds, but not really that's what. Need more about, explain more, give stories more. They give me approval, give me documentation. Like, this thing is not listed there.
He wants the documentation.
Yeah, that's a big thing.
Right.
And in fact, when clients come into my office, a lot of times they'll say, yeah, you can fill out the forms, but the INS doesn't. Almost the form is just like the beginning. It's all the supplemental documentation that you need to have with the form. And that's what will impact your case is can you, you know, if you say you lived at, ask you for your addresses for the last 5 years, well, they want you to produce the leases to prove your addresses. People don't realize that. So when you do that, you've got to be ready to prove that you actually lived at those addresses for the last 5 years. And if you can't, that's going to hold up your application because they will not approve you until they're certain of where you were over the previous 5 years.
Dennis Muchnicki, how much, we keep talking about this local control. How much control do they have at the local level? Could someone decide, you know what, it's okay, I believe you?
Yes. But the district director, basically, or the office director, has a lot of discretion. Depending upon how she chooses to exercise that discretion, he or she, it can create additional obstacles and impediments.
Susan, you met your husband while you were here in the United States. Did that help Susan in the process of applying for the citizenship? Susan, did it help or did it make it more of a hassle?
We hoped it would help, but it did not. It was not really, it didn't help any at all. Like now, I married my husband since 2009. We've been together since 2007, and we have two children. We hope in him, like we stay in here. We stay as a family. We know we're staying here for the rest of our life, me and my husband, my kids, but not really, it didn't help at all. So.
Is that pretty typical, Dennis, that getting married isn't what it's...
Well, a lot of times getting married is the basis for getting your green card, but Susan's husband was not a U.S. citizen.
Okay. All right. I want to – oh, I guess the caller went away. Go ahead, Susan. Did you say something?
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Did you ever stop and think this isn't worth it?
No, not really. I always think it worth it. I've always been thinking that way. Every time I go to interview, like, I went to a master hearing for many times, and every time I go home, I know, like, I can do better, and I'm going to stay here, and I'm going to do whatever it takes me to get my citizenship. I know it's worth it. Now I feel more comfortable living here. I feel more, I know my future is here, my kids' future is here, so I feel more comfortable after I applied my citizenship.
Did the immigration process and getting your citizenship, the whole process, did it seem fair to you?
I think, yeah, it's fair, but as we said, the time, maybe the cost sometimes, like, you know, certain families, they sometimes can't afford to apply for citizenship. I know a lot of people who have their green cards for many years, and maybe the financial reason they can't apply for citizenship. They say, I don't want to fill the application by myself and have problems, and I can't hire an attorney. I can't afford it.
Dennis Muchnicki, are there alternatives to you? I mean, you mentioned earlier that that Susan had a layperson fill out the asylum application and it was a disaster. But are there lay people out there that can help, that they don't have to be, you know, an expensive attorney?
The vast majority of the laypersons out there are actually detrimental. There are a couple of genuinely accredited institutions, nonprofits that produce competent work. Chris here in Columbus has some good people on their staff, and they do good work. But a lot of them tend to exploit their fellow former countrymen. You know, they're Latinos exploiting Latinos, Africans exploiting Africans. They just fill out the application. They basically are lay people filling out the application without an understanding of the technical language that is used in the application and without any concept of putting together the documentation to support the application. And again, as I said before, documentation is 90% of the application process.
Tom in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Thank you.
You wanted to say something about immigration and whether it should be easier or not.
Well, yeah, I did. First of all, I have no problem with immigration. You know, some of the smartest and hardest working people came here through immigration.
Mm-hmm. One of them is Susan, by the way.
Okay.
So I have no problem with that. But I don't think we should make it easier. You know, there's so many people in the United States, here in America now, it's such a vast amount of people, and there's very few jobs. That if we keep bringing people in and make it easier, you know, there's just going to be less and less jobs.
Okay. All right. So you're pretty comfortable with the process as it stands?
Yes, ma'am, I am.
All right. Well, Tom, thank you for your call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Take care. I am going to say goodbye now to Susan Robbie, a client of Dennis Muchnicki's and an immigrant from Palestine.
Great.
Thank you, Susan, for joining us and sharing your story.
Thank you. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to discuss about it and talk.
Dennis Muchnicki is going to stay with us. We're going to continue the conversation about the bureaucracy of immigration in the United States right now. So if you have any questions or comments, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Decision Day at the Supreme Court. Two landmark rulings on gay marriage. We're on it with top legal minds from across the country. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation in supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
You can discover more about WOSU Public Media by signing up for our WOSU FYI e-newsletter. Once you sign up, you'll receive a bi-weekly arts and culture e-newsletter featuring program highlights from radio and television, special event information, ticket offers, and much more. Just visit wosu.org/email to sign up. Wednesday night, watch WOSU TV to get a spectacular space-based vision of our planet on NOVA. Produced in consultation with NASA scientists, delight in the astonishing beauty and complexity of our dynamic planet. Watch NOVA, Earth from Space, Wednesday night at 9 on WOSU-TV.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Just a reminder, in a highly anticipated decision, the U.S. Supreme Court today ruled the Federal Defense of Marriage Act is unconstitutional. We will cover this decision in depth tomorrow on All Sides with Ann Fisher at 10 a.m. I hope you'll join us then. With a potential new compromise on the table, it appears that U.S. immigration policy might be in for an overhaul. The change would include expanding the number of temporary work visas available for skilled workers and applicants with college degrees, issues that involve colleges and universities. Joining us now to talk about that is Gifty Akoh-Aduvo. She's the Director of International Students and Scholars at Ohio State University. Welcome.
Thank you, Anne.
Also with us, still with us, I should say, is immigration lawyer Dennis Muchnicki. Dennis, thanks again for joining us.
Sure thing.
If you have a call, question, or comment, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Gifty, there are a lot of international students at Ohio State, 8.2% of the incoming freshmen in 2012. This is a big deal to colleges and universities that the immigration system be modified, be reformed, to make it a little bit easier for them. What are the issues and the challenges that people who are wanted mm-hmm. as students and staff and so forth, what are some of their hurdles?
For students, I think that the hurdles are not as high as those who are seeking citizenship directly. Because for a student to come to Ohio State, there is a very defined process that they go through. They have to meet all the admission requirements of the university. You know, they get admitted. After that, we decide what the most appropriate visa classification is for them. We make that determination based on the chapters 8 and 22 of the Code of Federal Regulations. And then we issue them the visa eligibility documents. They apply at a U.S. consulate in their home country for the visa, or if they are already in the U.S., their CVIS, non-immigrant record, mm-hmm. is transferred from that school to the Ohio State University. And so it's pretty straightforward. You know, sometimes there is a delay. We do have students whose visa applications go through what is called administrative processing, and that can greatly delay their arrival.
Anytime you put the word administrative processing, put those words together, I smell delay.
It is delays. You know, that is the point at which the State Department, through the consular offices are taking, I would say, or doing greater scrutiny with the particular application. And so by that very act, it just takes a lot longer. And so we have had a few students in that situation, but otherwise for them, like I said, it's a pretty well-defined process. For our scholars, and our scholars are our postdocs, our faculty, our physicians, et cetera, who the university sponsors for the H-1B visa, those can be a lot more complicated. And that's because just the entire process, there are so many players in it. There's the Department of Labor, the Foreign Labor Certification Unit, there is the university, there is U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services for the adjudication. Whenever you have that many players in a process, it can get very complicated.
Why are colleges and universities so interested in immigration reform as it stands now in Washington? What elements of it matter so much?
I think that the elements that matter the most are one, that one of the items in there is to make it easier for, well, when I say easier, I should say more straightforward, not easy, as you just said, you know, it's not easy, but to make it more straightforward for the U.S. to retain highly qualified individuals. We're talking, for example, about students who have been educated in the U.S., who have gotten, you know, a tremendous education here. And for many, you know, economically, it makes no reason, I mean, it makes no sense for these students to, you know, to leave after the education here. So it's very important that the U.S. is able to retain those who would like to stay. So one of the provisions in there actually allows students who have higher degrees and PhDs to have a more direct route to citizenship. So in essence, it would cut out, or I should say circumvent, well, maybe cut out is a better term, the intermediate H-1B process, which is pretty much the route that many students who would be staying in the U.S. would follow, where they finish their degree, you know, they have a higher degree, an employer employs them, goes sponsors them for the H-1B, and then after that, you know, they might get the green card and then citizenship. But it looks like that will cut out at least the middle portion and take them straight to the green card, and then, you know, shortly after that to citizenship. So I guess by that very definition, it simplifies, I use the term loosely, but simplifies the process a little bit. So like I said, you know, that would be one of the major reasons that after the investments that the students have put in, as well as the investment that the U.S. universities, for example, Ohio State has put into this, why not retain that talent in the U.S.? These are not undocumented individuals. These are individuals who've come through all the regular routes. It behooves, I think, the institutions and the U.S. to retain that talent.
Tomani in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Tomani.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So I was calling here. Thanks, La. I have been listening to a lot of other people, but my case is I don't know if I'm still in the process adjusting the status. But what happened to me is in 2007, while I was already married to a U.S. citizen, I have two kids here, 13 and 12 years old. They already approved my I-130, you know, they're like a petition for relatives.
Okay.
So I just drove to Buffalo, New York, and by mistake, I took the border toward Canada. So I made a U-turn to come back in. That's when my nightmare started. Those ICE officers, even though I was in process adjusting my status, these people claim they don't know how I entered this country. After fingerprinting me, showing me my record, how I entered here, how I changed my visitor visa to F1 student, how I got married and been approved the I-130, they still say they don't know how I enter here.
Okay. So, Dennis Muchnicki, you chuckled a little bit. This kind of thing happens, and they're just messed up?
Yeah, and Buffalo's a real tough place. Oh, yeah. Buffalo is very, that's a key border entry point, and they are very, very precise about everything. And it sounds crazy that a guy who just made a wrong turn and has been in the United States is all of a sudden deemed not to be in the United States. But I've heard that sort of thing with Buffalo before.
So, Tomani, where is it at now? Where are you still in process or what?
Yes, I'm still in process.
Okay.
So, since
you probably got put into deportation, didn't you?
Yes, I got put in deportation, and then I couldn't pay for the fees, even though I'm married to a U.S. citizen. But the really thing that troubled me, these people took money from me before releasing me, like $1,500. And that's the exact money I needed to file my for the fees.
Go ahead, yeah. Tomani.
Yeah, so I tried to get the money so I can pay for the fees to adjust my status, but they refused to release that. I did everything. They refused, categorically refused to release the money. I've been going to Cleveland this happened since 2010. So now they're telling me, okay, we have another form for you since you have a relative here. You have your kids here. You've been living here longer. You probably can go on a Justice Department website and print out 42B.
Okay.
Fill it out. That's a cheaper fees. I'm really troubled, man. This me and my family, man. I cannot do nothing for my kids.
You don't want to do a 42B?
Yeah. Okay, you know, unfortunately, Tomani, we can't get into the details and we can't go over your case explicitly.
I just want to know if if U.S. officials are allowed to just, you know, like a fabricated charge. Because what happened, they know exactly how I enter here. They fingerprint me and they show me the record.
Okay. They don't fabricate my charge.
They came out and say they didn't know how I entered this country.
They take a very technical and narrow definition of terms, and they use that against you. It's not that they fabricate it, but they will claim that you deported the United States. And if you went across the bridge and turned around, you technically you did. And so what they'll do is they will use a very hyper-technical interpretation of the terms against you. And, yes, it creates a nightmare for you. But they're not fabricating it. They are simply taking the narrowest possible interpretation, which is why frequently you need a lawyer to fight back and argue for a different interpretation of those terms.
Tomani, thanks a lot for your call. You know, he raised the issue of cost. How much does it cost to apply for citizenship?
The citizenship application itself?
Yeah.
You're talking about the citizenship process is not that much. I think it's, $640 is the application fee.
Oh, that's...
which sounds like a lot. It's small compared to some of the other applications. But it's about that much. That's just the application fee. That doesn't count if you want to hire a lawyer or have a lawyer go with you to the interview, that sort of thing.
Okay. Another example, Muhammad in Columbus. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. You had a little glitch in your process. What happened?
Hello.
Hi, what happened to you?
First came to the United States in 1999, came to Atlanta, Georgia. Lived there for a couple of years, and then decided to go to school one day. So I filed my financial aid and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I get a letter from the financial aid department saying that my name and my alien number don't match. Because when you come to the United States, basically you get something called an I-94, and on it is an alien number.
Sure, makes sense.
So,
yeah.
So I contacted them, told them what's going on. They told me the name on the alien number actually belongs to a Spanish lady. The name of Don Denisa, I don't remember the last name.
Well, that's okay. The point is, Dennis Muchnicki, what happens then?
To be blunt, that's when you go through hell.
Okay.
I mean, one of the things we need to find out in that case is, was that an administrative error made by the Citizenship Immigration Services when they issued the I-94?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how did that happen is one of the questions.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Particularly, I know for people of... this gentleman sounds like he may be Somali. Somalis, because they almost every they all have like three or four names. Almost every you take Ahmed, Mohammed, Hassan, and Abdi. In between those four names, you probably have 80% of all Somalis. There are real problems of identity confusion with Somalis because so many of them have the same names. And I can see where that occurred, that could occur in that situation. But how he got somebody else's I-9 alien number, that's got to be a glitch by USCIS.
Muhammad, thanks a lot for your call. We appreciate
Hello.
It. Hang in there. Hang in there.
Hello.
Yeah, we gotta take off right now, but I appreciate your call.
Okay.
All right, take care. Gifty Ako Aduvo, what we were just talking about the cost is that when you have a scholarship student coming in from another country, does the university help them with those costs?
The graduate students that we have, the majority of them do have some sort of graduate assistantship.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, they are either a graduate associate where they assist professors with research or assist with teaching, et cetera, and they get a stipend for that in addition to a fee waiver. And so there is that. But by and large, our undergraduate students are full fee and tuition paying, which is they are funded by their parents or families. Yes.
Basha in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Basha.
Hi, Anne. How are you? I love your show. I listen to all the time.
Thank you.
First of all, Mr. Muchnicki was my lawyer.
Okay.
And 5 years ago, I just applied my citizen. And I want to thank him also. The reason I called, I have a friend here. She's a student. So I don't know if she's asking questions. Like, she graduated in 2014, but she want to work here. She only here for the visa.
Mm-hmm.
So is there anything for that?
Does the university, go ahead.
Yes, I can address that. If she is a student in F1 status or J1 status, there is the benefit for F1 students called the optional practical training or OPT that allows a student to work in the U.S. in a job in their field of study for up to a year. If the person is a STEM graduate, they become eligible for another 17 months.
STEM meaning science, technology, engineering, math.
Correct.
Right. Okay.
For another 17 months of that. If, for example, she's in J1 status, that student would have really up to 36 months of academic training. It's a similar benefit, but depending on the educational level, whether it's bachelor's, master's, or PhD. So there is that. But once that benefit is used up, it's a little more involved. Students in F1 status get optional practical training per degree level. So after your bachelor's, you get your one year, and that way. But once they use that up, then that's over. And so, at that point, students graduates are looking at if they could be sponsored by an employer for the H-1B or something going forward.
All right.
So does she have to go to the immigration or does she have to go see a lawyer?
For the OPT, that's the optional practical training or academic training, that's done through the university. So that would be through the international office. For the H-1B also, it is done by the university on behalf, unless they're employed by a private company, in which case the company's lawyer would take care of that.
Basha, thank you for your call. I'm sorry we've run out of time. I want to thank Gifty Ako Aduvo. She's the Director of International Students and Scholars at Ohio State. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Anne.
Also, Dennis Muchnicki, Central Ohio immigration lawyer at the firm Muchnicki & Bittner. Dennis, thanks for joining us.
Sure thing. Enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.